From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A committee in charge of counterterrorism at the UN Security Council said the judges face many challenges in terrorism cases. Investigating and prosecuting those cases presents a number of barriers for the criminal justice systems of many countries that can include human and civil rights violations. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
The obstacles encountered in upholding justice in terror cases range from collecting admissible evidence to protecting the rights of witnesses, victims, and those accused of terrorism-related crimes, according to the UN Secretary General's chef de cabinet. Here's Edmond Mulet.
Judges are often themselves victims of reprisals. Many have been threatened and physically attacked. The harassment of lawyers and judges violates fundamental human rights and undermines both the rule of law and the independence and integrity of the courts.
Terrorism continues to be one of the greatest threats to international security, says Mulet. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
Almost as if intended to prove the point, a federal judge in New York ordered the payment of $10.5 billion in damages to families of victims who died on September 11, 2001, from Iran. The default judgment was issued by U.S. District Judge George Daniels in New York Wednesday. The ruling is particularly noteworthy since none of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were Iranian citizens. 15 were citizens of Saudi Arabia, while 2 were from the United Arab Emirates and 1 each from Egypt and Lebanon. RT's Caleb Maupin filed this report from New York Thursday.
The ruling is based on the fact that the 9/11 Commission report states that some of the hijackers visited the Islamic Republic of Iran a year prior to the 9/11 attacks and did not have their passports stamped. But it's interesting to note that the very same judge in this case who ruled that Iran was responsible and owed compensation to the victims of 9/11 had ruled that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was not responsible in a previous case. He has actually stated that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is not responsible, despite the fact that Zacharias Moussaoui, one of the convicted hijackers, has testified in federal court that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was involved in the planning. It is certainly going to put a strain on U.S.-Iranian relations.
China made an unusually strong criticism of the human rights record of the U.S. China's ambassador, Fu Kang, strongly rejected U.S.-led criticism of its human rights record at the U.N. Human Rights Council Thursday, calling the U.S. hypocritical, and said it was guilty of crimes, including murder and rape, around the world.
We resolutely reject groundless allegations of the U.S. on behalf of some states on China's human rights situation. The U.S. is notorious for prison abuse at Guantanamo prison. Its gun violence is rampant. Racism is its deep-rooted malaise. The United States conducts large-scale extraterritorial eavesdropping, uses drones to attack other countries' civilians, innocent civilians. Its troops on foreign soil commit rape and murder of local people. Its conducts of kidnapping overseas and builds black prisons. These fully reveal the hypocrisy and double standard of U.S. on human rights. The universal value that it agitates are nothing but national interest in disguised forms.
Friday marks the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. The country is set to mourn thousands who lost their lives in a massive 2011 earthquake that sent the tsunami roaring ashore and set off the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Today, 7% of Fukushima Prefecture remains in evacuation zone. About 100,000 people have yet to return home. CCTV's Zhen Yi Bing has more.
Construction of new homes is behind schedule. 20,000 people are still living in temporary shelters, and the government has repeatedly postponed the date for them to move into new homes. 5 years on, the problem of starting a new life and adapting to the new environment remains.
Today we bring you a discussion with Professor Richard Wolff about the U.S. election, and particularly the rise of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
The clue as to what is going on is the symmetry between the two parties, the Republican and the Democrat. I think what you're seeing is an historic decline in both parties, and I mean decline in a very particular way. And to explain this, give me a moment to go back. Mm-hmm. Capitalism is a strange economic system in more ways than one, but one of those where it's not so different from the systems that preceded it is it has a nasty tendency to produce pretty gross inequality. And the last 30 or 40 years of global capitalism has been doing that at a breakneck pace. A month ago, the Oxfam in Britain, probably the most famous institute studying world poverty there is anywhere, came out with that famous report, which had as one of its banner line statistics that the 62 richest people on this planet have together more wealth than the bottom half of the population, which is 3.5 billion people. Any system that concentrates wealth in that way, in so few hands, at the top of an economic system, and I don't just mean a handful of individuals, I'm talking about pretty much that 1% that we now contrast to the 99%. Anything, any system that concentrates that much wealth and the power that that always entails in so few hands has a fundamental political problem. If it coexists, as it does in our society, with universal suffrage, with the fact that at least on paper every adult, with a few exceptions, has the right to cast a ballot, and that those results, the majorities, make a difference, then it is always true, this, think of it as a basic principle, that the tiny rich minority at the top is vulnerable. It's vulnerable to sooner or later having the mass of people who are not rich, who are not powerful, who see the rich and powerful around them, who feel the difference, who harbor jealousy, envy, anger, resentment. Set aside for the moment, justified or not, really doesn't matter for what I'm about to say. This is not a tenable arrangement. The folks at the top understand only too well how vulnerable they are, usually understand that better than the mass of people understand the ultimate power that they actually have. So what the folks at the top have to do in a system like ours is cut a deal, make an alliance, organize a coalition, whatever words you like, to get a mass base, to somehow get a huge number of people in the 99% to agree to permit, if possible, to celebrate the system that makes a few people super wealthy at their expense, rather than look at it with anger, resentment, and jealousy. To get to the point here in America, the Republican and Democratic parties are the chief organizations that have organized the mass base for the economic system called capitalism. The Republicans link the support of free enterprise, the support of individual enterprise, the love of the market, the celebration of capitalism's efficiencies and all of that. They link that to a mass base in things like the religious community, the evangelical community, people who like to have guns at their disposal, people with a strong sense of patriotism, a love of the military, and so on. The Democrats organize an alternative base, union people, minorities, the poor, and so on. In each case, the party says, in effect, to its stalwarts, vote for us, get us into power, and we will do two things. We will preserve the system that gives the rich folks at the top pretty much everything, and in exchange, if you vote us into office, we'll use the government to do various things for you. If it's a Republican Party, well, we will prevent gay marriage or outlaw abortion or enable you to have a gun or whatever it is their mass organized base wants, at least a little of it, and ditto the Democrats. They'll provide you with some social welfare, some government services on top of your wages. And the deal is, in each case, that the rich at the top fund the political party, fund the chief candidates, keep all the grease on the wheels of this system. And then if people get sick of one party, well, then you go through a big theater and give it to the other party. For those at the top, it really doesn't matter, because what they need is the mass base, which both parties, the one in and the one out, are continuously cultivating, mobilizing, organizing, and educating as to the wonderful benefits of this whole arrangement. Trump on the right and Sanders on the left is about disaffection, is about this is breaking down. The masses in both cases are becoming more and more aware that the problem is the system as a whole, that this deal that they thought they were the beneficiaries of, Republicans in terms of what their government, when they're in power, gives them, the evangelicals, for example, are furious that they get lip service. They don't really get what they want. More and more of the mass of working class people look at the Democrats and are likewise furious that they get dribbles and drabbles, but that basically the system, and especially since the collapse of 2008, is simply not delivering even the little bit that they thought they got out of being the cheerleaders for the system in place. That's why I think it's historic. I think that the legitimacy, to use the word that theorists use, the legitimacy of our system that relies on the ability of those two parties to mobilize everybody, that's what's being undermined.
It seems that the agreement, essentially, to the sort of bullet point, what you just said, was for the political organization to be just about anything except the issue of economic equality. And as long as people could be mobilized to work on anything but that, that it was fine. But that rested on a certain contentment in the economic sphere. Certain things were delivered, even just the hope of certain things was kept alive, and that's disappearing now.
That's right. That's right. I would agree with you. I think that a key part of the glue holding it all together was a level of wealth in the United States, accumulated over the last 150, 200 years, that really had no equivalent anywhere else in the world. You kind of think of American history this way, that Europeans come here, they wipe out the native population almost totally, and take over for their new system in this country, an incredibly fertile land with unbelievable water and rivers and coastline on two oceans and all the rest of it. And they go to town. They have an explosion of wealth that the rest of the world needs. It starts with the cotton produced by the slaves in the South, and then goes on as they take over the rest of the country to produce a powerhouse of wealth. And that enabled so much to be concentrated at the top that you could generously line the pockets of the two major political parties, who in turn could give enough goodies, enough little door prizes to the people who voted for those parties, that, as you put it, there was enough to go around, or at least the prospect of getting enough your life.
That's right.
And that period is definitely over. It basically was over back in the 1970s. We papered it over for 30 to 40 years by substituting debt to allow people to continue to buy and have the so-called American dream, even though their wages had stopped rising in the 1970s in terms of real purchasing power. And then 2008, the debt pile on top ran out. You can only go so far with more and more debt, and the wage underneath, which in the end is how you pay it back, isn't rising. Well, then it's only a matter of time before the house of debt cards collapse. And that we'd had in 2008, and there is no going back, and there is no next step to take. So the pie is now not what it was, And in our culture, it's every man and woman for themselves. And the folks at the top have no intention of giving up their wealth accumulating procedures. And that means the parties don't have the wherewithal. They can't do it. And so they start to disintegrate. I think it's instructive, Don, to think, you know, take the country of Greece. You know, you think of it as so different from the United States. But in this regard, it not only isn't different, but it shows us our own future. Up until 2012, that's only 3-4 years ago, up until 2012, two major parties in Greece shared their society's political power pretty much like the Republicans and the Democrats did here. One, the conservative one, was called the New Democracy, and the more left-of-center one was called the Greek Socialist Party. And the two of them together would never get less than 75 to 80% of the vote. So for a few years, you'd have the prime minister be of the one party, then he would be voted out as people were irritated, and the other one would come in, and then the same thing would happen in reverse. It's just back and forth. And then suddenly, because of the crash of 2008 was so hard on Greece, because that little country was made to bear much more than its share of the contractions that had happened ever since, the breakdown of global capitalism ever since, you see an advanced state of what happened. In 2012, the two parties together dropped from getting 75 to 80% of the vote to getting 30 to 35% of the vote, enabling a left-wing, small left-wing party, Syriza, to take over, and that is the government of Greece today. And I think you're seeing an earlier phase, and no doubt it will be different. We're not Greece, et cetera, et cetera. But you're seeing the same disintegration of the old system for providing the mass base of a capitalistically concentrated wealth at the top. And we ought to pay a lot of attention to Greece, because that is where it's going. Doesn't mean it'll end there, and doesn't mean it'll evolve in the same way, but you have the same forces at play.
And, you know, you described, for example, you know, this pile of debt that started mounting in earnest in the late 70s, early 80s, that was used to paper over the crisis that was being reflected in the need for lower wages by capital and you know, greater extraction elsewhere. You know, this the contradiction had expressed itself in the 30s, and you had both the policies of the New Deal, but also, very importantly, World War II that interrupted that. And following World War II, the massive expansion of the American imperial system, basically, which fueled massive accumulation of wealth, even, you know, in the middle class and among workers here. And that was the collateral for that debt. And that's all been exhausted now. And in addition to that, that empire is crumbling. So what are the prospects for blowing air back into the system?
Well, you know, I'm always hesitant. I agree with you. I think these are the signs, and these are the important signs about where things are going. And it is certainly possible that we will have extremely serious social conflict and turmoil in the years ahead. But capitalism has been counted out or counted near death more than a few times. And so if one isn't crazy, one has to be a little bit careful about doing that one again. So let me be careful here. I think in some ways Bernie Sanders' proposals have more than a passing similarity to Franklin Roosevelt. He has been compared to Franklin Roosevelt as what his role in history might be. I believe it's fair to say that he has modestly, but nonetheless clearly, compared himself to Franklin Roosevelt. And I don't think that was just in order to say, well, look, I'm a kind of Democrat too, even if it's a little bit different from what you've become used to. So let's explore the possibility. The basic thing that Mr. Roosevelt did in a period not so different from this in terms of capitalism, having gone through a crash, 1929, and having imposed enormous suffering, unemployment, loss of homes, and all the rest, people who have ever read John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath or of Mice and Men and, or any of the literature of that time has a very graphic sense of it all. Well, a movement developed then, a movement from below, the CIO, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, working closely together, which they did, and they forced a major change. And to make it real simple, the change was tax the rich, tax the corporations, and give the money to the mass of people. I mean, that's getting a mass base in a real hurry, not through all the 8 million little program modifications that we've become used to since, but in a blunt way required by the urgency of the moment. So suddenly, you literally, overnight, you create Social Security, you create the unemployment compensation system, you create a government jobs program that hires, you know, 10 to 15 million people. It is staggering what that was able to accomplish in 1933, 4, 5, 6. And when it began to be not enough, 1937 particularly, you had the war. And the war was another massive reorganization. You put everybody to work. People had, in economic terms, you took all the unemployed that was still there, despite everything that the New Deal had done. You said, well, it's not enough. The system is starting to crash again in 37, and so in 38, and so you did the next thing. The only way that Mr. Roosevelt at that time could possibly have gotten the political support of both parties to put everybody back to work, to give everybody a check, to basically move the wealth in another direction, was for something that everybody would agree had to be done. And a war with a scary enemy in Germany, Japan, and Italy fit the bill. I'm not saying that's the only reason we went to war or anything else. I'm talking about the economics of it, and the combination of New Deal plus war was a redistribution of wealth on a massive scale that basically reversed the very inequality of capitalism that had culminated in the crash of 29. So you have to ask, could it happen again? The answer is, sure it could. Could you hypothetically at least have a government, whether it was Republican or Democratic, again, really doesn't matter, but could you have a government that did something similar in the way of a massive redistribution to correct an unsustainable inequality that is built up? I think the answer is yes, but here's the reason why I think this time it doesn't look to be happening. And that's because you don't have, or at least you don't yet have, the mobilization from below. You have nothing comparable to the CIO, the Socialist Parties, two of them, that became parties of mass importance across the United States, let alone the Communist Party, which was the best organized of all of them. You don't have anything like that. You don't have any of the individual components of that so-called New Deal coalition, and you don't have an alliance among them. And you have, in fact, 50 to 60 years of a society that has demonized every part of that alliance, has made communists appear to be devilish people who are agents of a foreign power, socialists to be more or less the same thing, that you just spell it differently, and the union movement is at the end of a 50-year decline and is unable to barely breathe, let alone lead the kind of social change that John L. Lewis of the mine workers and the CIO did back in the 1930s. So here's the irony that you could take away from this. What capitalism needed back in the 30s was that its enemies save it. The union movement, the socialists, and the communists, ostensibly critics, skeptics, or downright enemies of capitalism, made the push that forced capitalism to the adjustment that saved it. They've now destroyed the very people that were saved, destroyed the socialists, the communists, and the labor movement, right, and therefore go into their next collapse, the one since 2008, without the enemy they so badly need to survive.
And that the socialist and communist movements, workers' movements generally back then, had an international character, and the Soviet Union, and that's all gone now, too.
That's right. They had the, and Roosevelt, you know, he played on that as president. He went to the corporations and the rich, and he said to them, look, you see every day in the headlines, and they did, back in 1932 or 33, you see in the headlines every day, workers bitter, angry, marching down the streets with signs. On the other side of the same front page of your newspaper, you see headlines about Soviet Russia, where there is no unemployment, where the workers are in control. And he said to them, if you don't want the demonstrators on one side of the paper to make the revolution that will bring to the United States what happened in Russia that you see on the other side of the paper, you've got to give me the wherewithal to reconnect with the mass base, to give them enough in a period of depression that they don't turn against you. And there's a famous remark made by the father of John F. Kennedy, Joseph Kennedy, the guy who built up the wealth of that family up in Boston. And he was a big supporter of Franklin Roosevelt, and he gave an interview once. It has become iconic in American history records, and he said the following. Why, in answer to a question, why are you a rich millionaire, et cetera, why are you supporting Franklin Roosevelt? And he said, because I understand the deal. If I give him half my money for the New Deal, he guarantees that I keep the other half. And if I don't give him half my money, I'm at risk of losing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you convinced enough of the people at the top to see the world that way, then you get what the New Deal was. But in order for them to feel that way, they have to be scared. They have to be worried. And the folks at the top, at least so far, with a few exceptions, like Warren Buffett, who makes remarks like this, and a few others, but with a few exceptions like them, there doesn't seem to be that worry, that fear, that anxiety. It just seems to be we can go further and further and further down this path of accumulating wealth, and it's all like having a good time at a picnic.
So obviously building a movement is the next item on the agenda if people want to see change.
Absolutely. I mean, once whatever happens to Bernie Sanders, win, lose, draw, once that is clear, and the same thing will happen in its own way on the other side, whatever happens to Trump, the conditions that produce them are not going away, even if they, as individuals, do, and even if they, as a presidential effort over the last 12 months, even if those fade out, there's no reason at this point to assume you're not going to have another form of this. Basically, Bernie, to use one example, Bernie is the Occupy Wall Street movement, only it's now X years older, and it shows you that that movement, even though you might count the people who got involved in it in, say, a few hundred thousand, well, they've now become quite a few million, because that movement spoke to people, and even though that particular movement isn't around the way it was in those last months of 2011 and early 2012, it is literally coming back with a much louder roar and a much bigger bite. And I have no doubt, given the direction of our economic troubles, that the Bernie Sanders movement will be either be that movement or something that builds on that movement. And my guess is you'll see that in terms of the Trump phenomena in a parallel way from that side. And I don't mean to minimize the differences. I mean, the left and the right have very different explanations for what went wrong in this economy, for how it works, for what the causes of our dilemmas are, and they have very different ideas about how to solve them. But they are alike in reflecting the disintegration of the mass base for supporting capitalism that both parties were enacting in their different ways for now a long time.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.